Hello, and welcome to Tactical Startup. This week, we're going to be talking to Marissa Martin Talbert. Now, to give you a brief introduction, she is a very talented intellectual property and business attorney. We went to law school together, so I'm biased definitely for her. She's in the Navy Reserves, and her husband is in active duty Navy. She and I have ventured into the solo realm of being an attorney. We both have gotten along. We both were older and wiser, I'd like to think, law students. And she's fascinating to talk to. She's one of my favorite people from law school. We got along great. We had a lot of great classes. And I was so excited that she agreed to come on to my podcast. It's actually been a little while. We had scheduling snafus and we had things that kept us from being able to get together, but we finally made it work. And so I'm excited. The links for her to reach out will be below. So please don't forget, if you have any intellectual property rights that you need, she's currently working on some community outreach programs as well as a campaign. So she's very busy, but I know she'll take time to meet with clients. She's a fantastic person. And honestly, I'm so excited to have her on. So let's go ahead and get started. And yeah. You're listening to Tactical Startup, a podcast dedicated to building amazing businesses. I am your host, Taylor Darcy. In this podcast, we explore ways to innovate, improve, and level up your business through sales, marketing, automation, and business planning. Successful businesses pivot when times are bad and stay the course when times are good. We will have guests from different walks of life to help you see that success is not only possible, but even probable, no matter when or where you start. Through hard work and strategic planning, you can have the entrepreneurial life you've always dreamed. Tune in weekly to level up your business. So, I'm going to be bringing Marissa on. And again, so if you're going to reach out to her, make sure that you check out the links, the phone number below. Again, can't stress enough how amazing she is, and I am grateful that she agreed to come on. She has won numerous awards. In fact, she was just recently awarded the San Diego County Bar Association New Lawyer Service Award, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm correct on that one. I'm sure she'll correct me in just a second. So let's bring her on. Hello, Marissa. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Did I get that right about the San Diego County Bar Association?
That is correct. Awesome. Yes, it was New Lawyer Service Award.
Cool. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know the name, but I don't know what that implies or what that entails.
Yes. Yeah, so it is awarded to a lawyer that has been barred for less than 6 years. For their service in the community. And I believe, in addition to some of the other things I do, that award specifically was geared toward one of the ballot measures that I led, which is a part of San Diegans for Justice, an organization that I co-chair with another attorney. And we brought forth Measure B in 2020. To the city of San Diego that created an independent commission to investigate police misconduct. And that passed with 75% of the vote in the city of San Diego. So that was a long, hard feat, well fought. And so the culmination afterwards, I think part of the service award came from that.
Very cool. I know that I think I voted for that. I'm pretty sure I did. I don't remember, to be fair, because
understandable. 2020 was a long year. Yes, there was a lot going on, but it was a great success. So we were very proud of that.
Very cool. So how did you survive 2020?
So 2020 for me was, there was so much going on for me. In addition to campaigning Measure B, the ballot measure with San Diegans for Justice, I was also working on two other campaigns. So in addition to taking on clients, in addition to what I do in the Navy Reserves, I also was working on a mayoral campaign for San Diego and a congressional campaign, and the Measure B campaign. So for me, 2020 was nonstop. It was so busy, and that is kind of how I survived. I stayed completely busy with everything that I was working on, and everything that I had to do.
Nice. I know that I was trying to stay busy too, but it had its challenges to be able to keep pushing forward, even when, you know, things are not working the way that you're hoping they would. What do you do in the Navy Reserves?
So that's a little bit of a loaded question. If you're unfamiliar with the military at all, it will sound convoluted, but I will break it down to say my job is to be a surface warfare officer. That is kind of the description of what I'm qualified to do. But in that, then the role that I play is right now is executive officer. So I'm second in command, at my command, and I oversee about 70 to 80 sailors who go out on the ships and support the ships. And they may do maintenance, they do training and all of that. So I make sure that everything that we need to do as an augment command to support the active duty components, that we do that and that my sailors are taken care of. So
nice. So as executive officer, it's mostly administrative, I'm guessing. Is that?
I would say probably 60% of it is administrative. I take care of I oversee all the admin so that my commanding officer, who's my boss, doesn't have to. I mean, his job is going to be more operational, but also, you know, I'm also filling the cracks of when he's not available, when he's not around, those operational things that need to happen, that's going to fall on me. But I try to shield him and make sure that he doesn't have to worry about anything. So I would say, yeah, about 60% of what I do is admin, and the other 40% is operational. And that comes with helping the active duty components prepare, get ready, making sure that, you know, the ships are where they need to be. That they're fully ready and capable for, you know, going out on deployment or going out to sea or whatever else needs to happen.
Nice. Now, is that the same type of plan where it's 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year, or is your commitment more than that? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
More than that. That 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year is kind of a farce, especially as you grow in rank. For me, it's definitely more than that, because the things that my sailors need do not happen on the 1 week in a month schedule. Oh, right. Or year. When they need things, they need them. And there's deadlines and time, you know, time stamps that need to happen. So for me, I'm constantly working. The good thing is I can do a lot of that from home. I have a computer that's designated just for military work only. So I can do a lot of that remotely, but it is definitely more of a time commitment than that.
I wouldn't, just knowing you and knowing military, I wouldn't be surprised that that's true. What's your current, I'm a little bit of a, I love Navy, military. I wish I could have served. I wasn't able to because of my hearing. And so I actually went through the process at MEPS, and I took the ASVAB, all that good stuff, and I wasn't able to get past the hearing test. And so I met with the chief medical officer at the time, the Navy. It was the one that was at the medical officer there. This was in Florida that I did this, and he's like, you know, you go get your hearing fixed, come back and get a degree and become an officer for us. Well, unfortunately, I could never get my hearing fixed sufficient to serve. So I love any opportunity that I get to talk to somebody who served and appreciate their service, because I think you guys do amazing. And it was my heart to serve, but unfortunately not my body. So what's your current rank?
I am a lieutenant commander, which is an 04. So okay. The ranks are divided into enlisted and officer for people who are unfamiliar. Enlisted goes from E1 to E9, and officer goes from 01 to 010. Once you get past the 06 level, it's about 5% of the Navy that gets past that level into the flag officer levels, generals and admirals and things like that. Right. I am an 04. So, you know, I'm kind of right there, mid-level, mid-range, where I'm senior enough that people expect great things from me, and senior enough to you know, have command and really be in charge of some really incredible things and people. But I'm still fairly what would be considered a junior officer, when you think about the fact that it goes from 01 to 010. So I'm right there in the middle.
Nice, nice. Any chance you'll get your own command?
You know, that would be next. Now, because I'm an executive officer now, the only place for me to go is to be a commanding officer, unless I become an executive officer at maybe a larger command. So if I choose to pick the next set of orders, more than likely, I'll choose the officer.
Nice.
Jobs. And I don't know if I'm looking forward to that yet. I don't know if I want to do that. My husband is very much adamant about the fact that I should, because of the representation, or the lack thereof, rather.
Yeah.
So he's always encouraging me, like, you got this, you can do this, you're great at this. But I know me, and my time commitment has waned on what I am available to do in the Navy right now. So I don't want to take on even more responsibility and not be able to give it 100%. So I'm in flux about that right now.
Understandably. I completely get, you know, that, I have so many demands on my time. So I can certainly empathize with that. But I would say we need people like you. I want my daughters to see people like you in positions of authority and command, because I want them to see that, you know, they can do whatever they want to, no matter what that is. And so I'm with your husband on that one. I truly wish there was something I could do to help you to alleviate that burden so that you could give it 100% if that's what you want to do. Obviously, that is most important, because the last thing I'd want you to do is not do it, or do it and then not do it right, because that would cause more problems than it's worth, just because your heart wasn't in it. So I totally get that. But that's exciting. Like I said, I want my daughters to see that. I want all women to see that. I want all women to see that, you know, you can do whatever you want to put your mind to, and that, you know, you can. I mean, the Navy and military in general has been very patriarchal, and I feel like that needs to be torn down to say that, you know, women and people of color can do anything and everything, that there's no limits, right? And I don't like, you know, I don't like people or situations where people get promoted as a token, right? That it's like, oh, they do it just because of some reason rather than of merit. That sends the wrong message, right? When you see a movie and they have their token, you know, different roles, like, oh, here's this token person. It's like, no, the person is a person. It shouldn't be a token. They shouldn't be just there because of that. But anyway, I digress. So how did you get into, let's like transition into law, because that's kind of more of what we talked about. I wanted to talk about the Navy because, like I said, I geek out over Navy and I wasn't able to serve. How did you decide law? What created that transition? Because military to law, and you're not in JAG, they don't seem to work together. So tell me more about that.
So the military was actually my means to an end to get to law. It was my stepping stone to get to law. So I knew very early on as a young child that I wanted to be a lawyer. Nice. The area of practice was not so clear. I thought I wanted to do criminal law. And once I took criminal law in law school, I realized that was not the area of law for me. I took those cases home. I lamented over those cases. It was stressful on me. And I knew if I went into that area of practice that I would bring that home and be burdened by either prosecution or defense, but I would be burdened by those matters. But when I took business law and I did an internship with New Media Rights and really got into the intellectual property space, I realized how much I really enjoyed that area of law. But taking it back a step, like I said, I knew I wanted to be a lawyer from a very young age. I did not know how I was going to pay for law school. So I went to a private school for undergrad. I went to Baylor University. It was very expensive. I did get some financial aid, but that was most of it came from my parents' pockets. And so with the culmination of my parents' financial aid and student loans, you know, I got through undergrad. When I graduated, I said, I'm going to take a year off. I'm going to work. And then I'll figure out how to get to law school. Like, I just want to take a year off. And then I will start law school. So when I took that year off, started working at the Texas State Capitol, Texan. I started working at the Texas State Capitol. I loved every minute of it. And I stayed for 2 years there.
Nice.
So I already blew my 1 year mark, right? My 1 year deadline. I had blew that because I worked there for 2 years. I absolutely loved it, but I was also very jealous by working around a bunch of attorneys. So I'm like, I love what I'm doing. I could totally stay here and just climb the ladder. But I'm around all these people who went to law school and I'm jealous. Yes, back to my original thought process. I'm going to law school. So I resigned and, before I resigned, I thought I can just work full time here. And they were completely like, we will help you, you know, we'll help you with your schedule. They were completely supportive. And so my plan was to work full time at the Capitol and to go to law school. My mom said, that's a terrible idea. You're going to stress yourself out. I know how you are. And I said, Mom, I can handle it. And she said, no. She said, you are going to go full force and you're going to completely stress yourself out. Why don't you join the military? Now, both my parents retired from the Army.
Okay.
So she said, why don't you join the military? You should join the Air Force. It's a great quality of life. You'll get paid. They'll pay for your school completely, 100%. I said, Mom, that's the worst idea I've ever heard. Why would you say that? And for 6 months, I went on about my life, applying to law schools, planning to do what my first thought was, work and go to law school. So I realized maybe Mom has a point. And I went to see a recruiter. And when I went to see the recruiter, I was like, okay, I can go in as an officer. They're going to pay me. All I have to do is 4 years and they'll pay for my 100% of my school. Okay, like maybe this is kind of the way to go. So that I ended up going that route. And I joined the Navy, did 4 years active duty, got out, and they paid for 100% of law school, which was, I look back and I'm like, what? That was the best decision that I could have made. I'm so grateful to my mom for suggesting that to me, even though I thought that was a terrible idea at the time. And I'm so happy to have done that. And then when I actually got out of active duty after my 4-year mark, I thought, well, I kind of enjoyed some of this, actually. Let me stay affiliated. Right. And so that's how I, you know, transitioned to the Navy Reserves. But that was my means to an end to pay for law school originally. Otherwise, me and the military would not have mixed. When I left for boot camp for officer candidate school, all of my friends from home thought I was going to come back within like 2 to 3 weeks. They never thought I was going to make it through. As a teenager, as a young person, I was the one who was like, I did not work out. I had discipline. I always had the discipline, but I was physically not the person that you would think was going to go into the military. I didn't like to sweat. I never played sports in high school or anything like that. But my mental fortitude was like, if this is what I have to do to get to law school, then this is what I have to do. So we're going to make this work. Nice. But like, best decision I ever could have made.
How do your parents feel if they were both Army? How did they feel about you doing Navy? I got to hear this story.
So the thing was, they both said, don't go into the Army. Okay. They wanted me to go into the Air Force, though, because they thought, you know, knowing the person that I was, like what I just described, they were like, the Air Force is a little more lenient. So if you're going to do any branch, the Air Force is the way to go because they treat people really well. The Navy wasn't even a thought. And at the time, like, I didn't know anyone in the Navy, but that's what attracted me to the Navy. So I knew people in the Marine Corps, but that was just way, way past my level of, like, comfort. The Marine Corps is truly, they are gung-ho. But I knew people in the Marine Corps. I knew people in the Air Force. I knew people in the Army. I didn't know anyone in the Navy, and I wanted to be different. I'm like, well, if I'm going to go into one of these military branches, I know people in all of these branches. So what's the Navy doing?
Right.
And so that kind of attracted me because I didn't know much about it. And I went into the Navy, and both my parents were really shocked, but in the end they were really proud. Like, this is amazing.
Yeah, I have friends in the Navy, I have friends in the Army, and I have friends in the Marines. It's hard not to be in San Diego where you don't have friends right. in the Navy or Marines. Like, just there's just a lot of people here. And there's that, you know, go Army, beat Navy, go Navy, beat Army at the you know, games, football game, whatever game.
Yeah.
So that's why I was curious how your parents feel. So they were more concerned about you as a person rather than an Absolutely. Affiliation to the Army. So that's good. I think that's good for parents, because I think, you know, a lot of times, I mean, I know I do, my expectations for my children are, you know, I won't go into the details, but point is sometimes your expectations get in the way of the child's abilities. And you got to check that, right? Like, expectations of others in general. But I had two uncles that were actually in the Air Force, and both of them told me, they're like, okay, because they were both enlisted. And they said, if you're going to do it, this was before my hearing issue happened. So at that point, it was a realistic possibility. They said, if you're going to do it, go in as an officer. Don't go in as enlisted, because you know the old saying, you know what rolls downhill. You know, you don't want to be an E1 if you can avoid it. And so in all my plans and all my thoughts, I had always planned on, you know, doing officer. But, you know, then you get the people that are trying to talk you into, oh, if you go in as enlisted and then transition into officer. And but the problem is that can get denied. You cannot get approved. And there's just too many things that can go wrong with that. So the idea of going in as an officer makes a ton of sense.
That's one of the stipulations. My parents was like, they were both enlisted.
Yeah.
And they retired both pretty well up in the enlisted ranks, but they both were like, you will not go in enlisted.
Yeah. Yeah.
you shall not.
Yeah. Yeah. And understandably, I mean, they want better for their daughter than they wanted, you know, than what they both went through. I totally get that. So you went to law school thinking criminal law, and then, excuse me, and then you decided no criminal law, you know, some of the things that you did, and then you moved into intellectual property and business. And so what are some things that, I was on the fence as well when I went to law school, but then I realized that what I wanted to, for my family, as well as my parents were carpet cleaners and business owners. And so for me, going into business law and doing business stuff made a lot of sense because I saw a real need with smaller businesses that needed legal help. And I know my parents could have used me many, many years ago. So tell me about, you know, let's transition into talking about your current legal office, what you do, what makes you different, how you want to be thought of, because, you know, for my listeners to be able to reach out to you and whatnot.
Well, so for my law practice, the focus is business, nonprofit, and intellectual property law. I think there's a lot of, you know, law firms that do business, business formations, contracts, and those things. So I don't know that there's a huge difference in that realm. And you know, I offer those services. I think really what makes me different is where I veer off into the nonprofit sector. There are a lot of nonprofits in San Diego, I mean, and throughout California, but a lot of nonprofits specifically in San Diego, I think over 11,000. And they are really struggling with legal compliance and just not understanding what California places on them, the burden that California places on nonprofits at being a public entity. And so I really get really personal with my nonprofit clients, really making sure that that what they're doing outwardly matches their infrastructure, making sure that they don't have to worry about anything but the mission, and making sure that they're setting themselves up to grow and be successful and not running their nonprofit organizations like a mom and pop shop, but really setting up that succession planning, really making sure that they have the infrastructure in place to pass that on and really running it like the corporation that it is. Right. I tell, you know, my nonprofit clients all the time, this is a business that is not for profit. It's not just some little organization that you kind of put together and said, you know, we want to do this or we want to help the community in this way. This is a business. It is just a business that is not for profit as opposed to a business that is for profit. So I really try to that distinction with my nonprofit clients. The other part is the intellectual property. And I know a lot of people are, there's, you know, a lot of folks do intellectual property, but I am really intentional about educating my clients around what their property rights, their intellectual property rights are, how they maintain those, really making sure that they understand what they're doing. Because a lot of people don't understand what a trademark is, even though they want one. They know, yeah. Okay, I want a trademark to protect this, but they really don't understand what all is going on. They don't understand how to properly use their trademark. They don't understand what the categories of goods and services mean. Like, they don't understand legally what is really happening. And so I'm very intentional about really educating clients and non-clients, to be quite honest. Really educating the community on what intellectual property is, how to use it, the differences between the different types of intellectual property, and really making sure that they are understanding the asset that is being built when they engage in protecting those rights. So I'm big on education. And I want to make sure that my clients are fully, fully informed. I've had clients come to me from other really big names, really big firms in San Diego. And they're like, oh, they didn't tell me this, or they didn't do this, or they formed my business, but they didn't give me an operating agreement, or they formed my business, but I don't have a shareholders agreement. Excuse me?
Right.
What? And you paid this amount of money with this big name law firm that has this big building downtown, and they didn't give you the proper tools that you need. This is what the law requires, and they didn't provide you with this stuff. So that makes me upset.
Yeah,
it makes me mad when I get clients from other firms where they've terminated the attorney, the other attorney, and they come to me and said, I need your help because this happened and this happened. I don't know what's going on. So I want to make sure that my clients are fully informed and that they have everything they need.
Yeah,
that's really it. I want to make sure that they have everything they need.
That's I see that quite frequently too. I mean, we run in similar circles. I don't focus as much on nonprofit as you do. I think that that's admirable, and I think you're absolutely right. I see this all the time. People treat it as a hobby instead of a business, and that's a real issue. In fact, one of the big differences between what I've seen, successful businesses and unsuccessful businesses, is their mindset. Are they treating it like a business, or are they treating it like a hobby? I'll do it till I find something else, right? Or are you actively managing it? Are you thinking, okay, what's my return on investment? Am I building an infrastructure to help me get to the next level? Or am I just kind of like hoping and praying for the next thing? You know, do I sit and I plan? Or am I just like, it'll come if it's meant to be, you know? And so you get this real issue that I see a lot of, where it's not that their business idea isn't good. It's that they don't put the work into it, or they don't put the mindset into it. And mindset kicks work any day, right? Because if you have this laissez-faire or a passive mindset for things, that's what your business is going to get. And then you're going to go, well, I failed, or I didn't work out. Well, it wasn't because your idea was bad or that your business was bad. It was that you didn't transition from that employee mindset of work given to you versus you are actively pursuing work. You're actively pursuing those things. Like, you don't get, like, when I have a client, I don't get, you know, I don't have a boss sitting over me saying, okay, now you have to do this. And a lot of business owners struggle with that because they're so used to being told what to do rather than figuring it out themselves, that, you know, they're good at their job, but they're not good at managing a business because they've never had to do that before. And even within, like, say you're a senior vice president of a company, you're still not managing a business. You're managing a department. There's so many other things that you have to worry about than that. And so, you know, these businesses do that. So what's your favorite thing to do?
At this point, because life is so hectic and busy, my favorite thing to do right now is almost nothing, which is still something. Typically, it's me sitting at home watching TV with my husband. And that doesn't happen often. So when I get the chance to do it, I really enjoy it. And I just binge.
What's your favorite show right this second?
So lately, now that it's available on Amazon, I have been going back through and rewatching A Different World, all the episodes and seasons of A Different World, which I can probably watch every day, all day, any day. I love, love, love that show. And so I spend a lot of time watching A Different World.
Nice. That's a good show from my childhood.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was a little crazy. I love The Cosby Show. I love A Different World. I'm actually listening to, so my podcast I'm listening to right now is Mayim Bialik's Breakdown, which she was on Blossom in the early 90s, and she was on Big Bang Theory. And that's something I'm listening to. But my wife and I were watching Baby Daddy, which is a cute show about a boy who finds a baby on his doorstep from a one-night stand. And anyway, it's worth checking out. It's cute, fun, real light. If you're not, like, you know, wanting anything too serious that, you know,
yeah, I can't do serious stuff these days.
Yeah.
Life is serious. Real world is serious.
Right. Right. And I mean, I'm just grateful that I feel like, at least for me anyway, that our current climate is changing for the better, with different, and not to get too political because this isn't really a political podcast, but I think that we're moving in a positive direction when it comes to Black Lives Matter, different types of movements that are out there that are, I feel like, are pushing forward in equality and equity. And I think that, I mean, yes, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, the COVID definitely wreaked havoc on a lot of businesses and a lot of people. And I never want to diminish that. But I think those of us that are living have to push on and keep moving forward and keep, you know, making sure that it isn't just about what's equal. It's about what's fair. Right. I mean, life is never going to be 100% fair. Right. I mean, there's never going to be a situation where, like, and I tell this to my business owners, your greatest asset is your ability to pivot. Right. It's not fair that you don't have the assets that someone else does. There's nothing fair about that. But you can still treat people with kindness and respect. You can still treat people like human beings. And I think that's one of the strongest things that most small business owners have that big businesses don't have, is that attention to the person, right? Something that, you know, when as you were saying earlier, I get clients from big law that got mistreated, you know, that felt like that their matter wasn't taken seriously, or that they felt like that the person was just there to, you know, get their money as opposed to solving the problem. And so I solve problem first and money, it just flows naturally. And I think that's a lot of issues that entrepreneurs, they're looking for the money instead of solving the problem. And if they look to solve the problem, they're going to be more successful because people don't mind paying when they feel like that they've got the problem being solved. And especially big law, when they don't solve the problem, you're like, then what do I pay for? You know, I've gotten several clients. In fact, this is memorable. I had one client come to me and they'd paid $7,000 to a local big law for a contract. And I looked at the contract and I was like, it's worth maybe two, maybe three if you're pushing it. And I mean, like, if you're really super duper, like, you know, trying to spend as much time on it as possible. But I looked at the bill and it blew my mind. I could not believe it. And I genuinely looked at the contract. It wasn't a bad contract, but it wasn't a $7,000 contract. I mean, like, it was not for a $7,000 thing. I mean, you know, if we're talking $1 million deals and where there's lots of due diligence involved, then sure, that makes sense to spend money on a contract like that. But this was a simple service contract between two businesses. I mean, it was just absurd. And I looked at it and it blew me away because there wasn't the value there, yet they were asking. No wonder people get pissed at attorneys. I mean, justifiably so. You know, if I charge $7,000 for that, sure, I'm loving my life with the money. But I mean, ethically, I can't imagine charging that for that product. A different one, perhaps, you know, if it's a crazy deal, sure, 7, 10, 15, if it needs to be, but not for that. It was so not worth it. So, so what's your favorite thing to do in law? Because I know we talked about, like, trademarks, and you're just talking about nonprofits, but.
In law, I think I will say really working with my nonprofits. I love working with my nonprofit clients more because, you know, with the autonomy that comes with having your own practice, which you are well aware of, you get to choose your clients as much as they get to choose you.
Right.
And for the nonprofits that are my clients, like, I actually support their work and their mission. And, I love seeing them make these wins. I love seeing them move from one step to the next. I love seeing their growth. It's really rewarding. I love it.
I'm 100% with you on that. Like, I mean, I don't really focus on nonprofits. I've started a few, but that's not my passion. So I know that I know who to come to when I have someone, because I'd much rather have someone that they truly enjoy what they're doing. And I think that's key. You know, it's my passion is helping business owners, but for profit. And I think that there's a misnomer, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, the nonprofits, yes, they do good, and I will 100% get behind them. But you know, people that are, especially the people that I help, we're not talking these big conglomerates that have, you know, ample, crazy amounts of resources. The people that I help most frequently are the small business owners that need to transition into, you know, from mom and pop ideas to bigger, bolder, you know, that type of thing. And so, you know, there's kind of this idea in society right now where, oh, we've got these corporations that aren't paying their fair share. I mean, let's face it, Amazon, Apple, some of these companies that are paying zero in income taxes. And then we get these mom and pop businesses that are paying 20-30%. You know, and it doesn't take a genius and a rock scientist to figure out that, how is that fair? A business that has billions should be paying their some taxes. I'm not saying I don't want to stifle, you know, capitalism by any means. I think it's a valid opportunity for people to make money. But at the macro level, you know, there's a huge amounts of budget deficits that we could be closing simply by taxing people that are taxing businesses that rightfully so deserve to be taxed. I mean, like, I'm not talking about being unjust, you know, in being saying, oh, we should tax them absurd amounts, but you know, they should be taxed, right? And I think that that's, if they don't want to be taxed, then they should find a way to become a nonprofit. I mean, right? I mean, that's, you know, comply with the rules of becoming a nonprofit if you don't want to be taxed, rather than loopholes that when you should be taxed rightfully. So that's good to know. I'm glad we had this talk, because I've always put you in the mind of, okay, I'll send you, you know, trademark work or copyright work or that type of thing. But I will keep that in mind for nonprofits. So we're coming to the end here. I think can you believe we've been on for like 42 minutes, 45 minutes, something like that? No, it's blown by.
Yeah.
Before we end, though, I wanted to ask you a couple of fun questions just for my listeners to get to know you. And so the first one is, who is your favorite hero of fiction?
Fiction is fake, right?
Yes. I have to do the same thing. Don't feel bad.
I think I'm going to say oh man, come back to me on that one. Superhero of fiction.
All right. So what's No, you're good. Okay. What's the favorite thing you've bought this year? Which COVID, I mean, that could be, you know, anything. House. Your house?
Yes, I bought a house this year. I actually closed 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Nice. Now, are you in the house?
No. It's actually in a different state.
Oh my. Wow. That's good. I look forward to buying a house.
Where my mom lives. So okay. When I go visit her, I have a place. I mean, I can stay with her, but yeah. I bought it for in the future, long term, so that, you know, if I ever need it to be there for a long extended amount of time.
Right. That's good. But San Diego housing prices are absurd. I mean, just like they're nuts. It'll be a while before my wife and I are able to afford a house here. We love it here. I don't see us ever moving anywhere else, but the housing prices are just killing us right this second. So we'll wait till we're in a better position to do that. But I look forward to that. Next one is, which band or artist, dead or alive, would play at your funeral? Forget about the part that you're dead. I'm just saying, like,
which band or artist?
Yeah.
So it's a, can I like say who I'm like leaning between?
Sure. Hey, it's your answer. I'm not.
So the first person that comes to mind would probably be like maybe Kirk Franklin, because I think he would make it not so morbid. But then the other person that comes to mind is John Legend, but I don't know if that would be as appropriate at a funeral. So, those are the two people that I think of off the top of my head. And I don't know why, but I would say I'm going to go with Kirk Franklin, because I think he would make it a celebration.
Okay. That's cool. That's cool. I'm guessing, and your husband would be okay with John Legend if necessary.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's your funeral, so you do what you're going to do. I can imagine. That's all I'm saying. All right. Next question is, what do you consider the most overrated virtue?
It's hard to say what is considered virtues these days, but I mean, you spoke about kindness earlier. I think kindness is necessary, but it did make me think kindness versus being friendly. I don't know if friendly is a virtue, but I think there's a bit of a difference, and I think people expect people to be friendly.
Right.
When it's like, why? Especially if we're not friends. And I think people throw friends, like that word, around very loosely.
Yeah.
So if friendliness is considered a virtue, I would say it's overrated. Because you can be kind without being friendly.
Right.
You're really friends, then you just are really friends and you don't have to be friendly.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's funny you say that, because once upon a time, I'm a friendly person. Like, I like to be friendly to people. I try not to be rude. I try to be respectful of others and whatnot. And people have mistaken the friendly for something more than friendly. And I'm not to go into too much detail, but I've gotten in trouble for it. And people thought I meant something that I really didn't, just because I was being friendly. And it was like, okay. And it taught me, okay, you got to be very careful on how friendly you are to people, because they might take it the wrong way. And you're like, okay, I had no intent to do that. And so I'm kind of with you on that one, because that just makes... is that, can we be respectful, polite, and kind to others without it being misconstrued as something that it's not, vilified for something that, that doesn't deserve to be vilified.
Can I circle back to the hero question? So for the hero of fiction, this is a hero of mine. It may not be of a lot of other folks, but I'm going to say Anne of Green Gables. It is a book series and a movie, and I grew up reading it and watching the movie, and I absolutely, it's one of my favorite movies in the world. And one of my, I just love Anne of Green Gables. And it's about a little redheaded orphan who grows up. She gets adopted, and it's the journey of her as she grows into this wonderful, beautiful woman. She's very wordy. She's very hot tempered at times, but she's just a beautiful soul. And I love Anne of Green Gables. So I'm going to say she's my hero of fiction.
Nice. I've never read the books, but I have watched the TV series that was out many, many years ago. Do you remember Pippi Longstocking?
Yes.
Okay. Same. She was right there too. The crazy hair, all that stuff. I remember those. And I like Anne of Green Gables. Wasn't there another series? Anne of Avonlea. When she grew up. Okay. Yeah. That's what I thought. It's been forever since I've seen those, but yeah, absolutely. They did a remake recently on Netflix, and I heard it wasn't good. Yeah.
I'm going to automatically refuse a remake. But the originals, oh my gosh, I grew up on Anne of Green Gables, and I adore.
Yeah, I remember her being, again, women empowered. I mean, especially you know, it's been patriarchal for too long, right? I mean, you don't, how do I say this without going into too much detail? You don't hear women blowing up things. I mean, like, you know, if you look at the potential for gun, you know, violence and whatnot, when was the last time you heard of a mass shooter that was a woman? I mean, and that's an extreme example, but I mean, there have been like one, two, maybe even three serial killers in the history of the world that were women. I mean, we need more women. We need more people that have kind hearts and positions that aren't, you know, hurting others, right? And that's I think it's such a strong point. And that's what Anne of Green Gables, you know, for me anyway, when I remember her, was she was a strong woman and a strong girl that, you know, had a challenging childhood, but grew up to be amazing. So, it has been so great catching up with you. Honestly, like you are one of my favorite people from law school, and I always look forward to hearing from you, even if it is, you know, infrequent. I only wish we had more time to talk. I know at one point we had discussed you coming on and being a partner and working together, and that didn't materialize, but I just want you to know that I still think of you as an esteemed colleague, and I always look forward to talking with you and celebrating your wins, because, you know, each day, especially when we're struggling, it's a win is a win, right? So is there anything you'd like to tell my listeners before we go?
I don't know that I have anything else. I would just say this was great. I will echo your sentiments. It is truly a pleasure. I love when we get to catch up. You know, we're in this together. So even though it's infrequent, there's no love lost. And, you know, you can call me or I'll call you and ask you, hey, what do you think about this? Or I got a question about this. So it's great to see both of us kind of doing our things and, you know, and all the different ventures that come along with it. So.
Awesome. It's a tight community. All right. Well, let's see. We're going to go with. So thank you so much for listening this week on Tactical Startup. Marissa is an amazing attorney. I can't say enough great things about her, her devotion to country, her devotion to her husband. I'm a better person for knowing her. And so please, if you have any type of nonprofit work, please reach out to her and engage with her, because I know that she will help you reach your goals and get you where you want to be. And I have every confidence in her, which says a lot, because I don't put my name behind anybody without that respect. I don't just throw out my endorsement for the sake of endorsing someone. So I want you to consider that as you're thinking about your building your business tactically, because in the end, that will be the difference between your success and your failure. So until next time, build that business tactically. Oh man, always fun to try to end a sentence that way. So until next time, we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.